This is Out of School, a podcast at the intersection of technology and education. My name is Fraser Spears, and I'm joined as always by Bradley Chambers. Tonight we've got two sponsors for the show. We've got Aerohive, makers of the great cloud controller Wi-Fi, and Jam Software, makers of the great Casper suite for iOS and Mac deployments. We'll tell you more about both of those as the show goes on. Bradley, good evening.
It is a multiple cups of coffee afternoon for me.
Some days have just got to be like that.
Well, my kids were up half the night, so the day started off on the wrong foot.
Oh, okay. It's hard to recover after that, isn't it?
Well, then they probably took a nap this afternoon, and they normally, my oldest one normally doesn't, so he'll be up late tonight, and it's just it's a nasty cycle. But what are you going to do?
What are you going to do? Yeah. We had to buy additional blackout blinds for the girls' rooms this week because obviously it's getting on for the Scottish summer, and being this far north, it's late into the night before it's dark. About now, maybe, what? Well, it's still light now. It's 8:30 here, so we've got about another hour of daylight, and I want the kids sleeping at the normal time.
Yeah, the normal rule is that if it's not dark, then we don't have to sleep. It's like, no, it's still 8:30. It's time for bed.
But yeah, that never works in the winter when it's dark at 4 o'clock. They're not begging to go to bed at 4 o'clock. I mean, I would take that deal if it was available.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So, I've got to stay a little bit later this afternoon and reboot a couple of switches. Yeah, I mentioned that power outage last week, and I've had two switches I think are kind of malfunctioning, and I don't think they were on the UPS, but I'm wondering if that UPS wasn't supplying enough power to them. And so I think I need to like give them a reboot because I can't get into the management of them. So that's like, I've had a couple of, I had two employees that like were having dropped connections, but you'd put them on Wi-Fi and it was fine. And that they were at, stationary. So they were Etherneted in. So traced it back to two switches and so I'm going to reboot those when I leave. Good times.
Okay. Yep. All the usual stuff. We've got another round of the famous digital exams tomorrow. And this is the hardest one because this is the one where it's biology, but we've got lots of people sitting them at different levels and different courses and so on. So there's two or three different ones to configure for different things. But I always hate this one because this is the one that we do with it's a PDF form and it comes on a CD-ROM from the exam board. So, I have to find a CD-ROM drive somewhere, but I've got a plan for that. But because the questions are on the paper as well, you have to handle the CD-ROM in the same way that you handle the exam papers, which is through all the security procedures and stuff. So the rule is you're only allowed to open the CD-ROM 1 hour before the scheduled start of the exam, which I always feel is just, like, what if something goes wrong with that? You got 1 hour before, what if, the way they formatted the paper this year crashes my PDF reader or something like that, because they certainly haven't tested it on iOS, I'm sure. So it's going to be a stressful day tomorrow, and if we get through it, if you hear another episode and have not given up on life after tomorrow, then I'm sure it'll be fine.
Well, good luck. Godspeed.
Yep. it's tricky because these procedures don't scale up. You couldn't possibly have 100 people sitting a digital exam. It's so, labor intensive to put it together for one or two pupils that 100 would just be impossible.
We've got next Friday is our official last day of school, so like our younger grades are actually done this Friday, so our school is going to be thinning out soon. And
okay,
so yeah, good times.
And then you get to redeploy everything, which is the best bit of the year.
Yeah, the nice thing is I did a lot of the hard work was last summer, and so this will be a little bit, the new deployment summers are always a little challenging.
Yeah.
And so it'll be just kind of, I'm going to clean up our cabling this summer, our patch panels and the switch closets. The cable, they're like 6 foot cables and they need to be like 3 foot. So I'm going to clean that up and all the usual database work, promoting students, report cards, things of that nature. Just because of the nature of it, I input all the lunch charges. And so, I'm trying to collect money from people to close out the year financially on lunches. Like, come on, you got to pay us, guys. It's like the IT guys hunting you down for money.
Yeah, well, you can hack into their bank account and figure that out.
Well, the leverage on the fifth graders is they don't get transcripts unless we get their lunch payments. And we have people that owe us $400 or $500 that, haven't paid all semester for whatever reason for lunch. And, we will get it or you won't go to middle school.
Well, that is most definitely a leverage. Yep. I'm trying to decide at the moment whether or not to bring my iPads back in for the summer. Like the primary kids ones, I'm going to do that anyway because we're going to wipe them and move over to managed distribution on those ones. So they're all going to come in. But I'm trying to decide whether or not to bother with the secondary kids. My concern being that because it's a school iPad versus a home, their whatever one they've got at home, that they'll sit sort of unused in a corner for 2 months, you know, whereas if it was at least in the school, it would be sort of, you know, in the right place and we'd have it for next year. But then there's always somebody who, like, you know, I haven't touched it for 6 weeks and I can't find it, you know, after summer. So I'm debating possibly just having everybody hand it in over the summer.
Yeah, I could argue that both ways on, you know, because you might see does someone take it on vacation to the beach and it comes back all sandy? I mean, that's not that's obviously the extreme. But do you have like a damage issue over the summer? It's the question. Of course, again, I think your policy is that if it breaks on their time, that they have to swap it. But there again, you know, let's say something new comes out over the summer. Let's say for whatever reason iOS 8 dropped late summer.
I could deal with that, yeah.
Right, and so, yeah. But it'd also be nice to not have to deal with them, you know, at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing I'm always nervous about is, you know, having all the equipment sitting in the school all summer, you know, when nobody's here and nobody's really watching.
Yeah, we've got, of course, I'm here all summer, and then I've got access to our CCTV system for my phone, and and so it's, you know, we can kind of, you know, log in and check in on stuff. But no, that's always a fear of mine that, like, you know, like on the weekends, I have 80 iPads in my office charging. And that's, if you somebody like unlock my door accidentally, then that's a lot of money. That's an insurance claim.
Yeah. What I may do is give 10 to every teacher in the school.
Yeah, it's like we'll distribute these. Yeah. It's like Jack Bauer. before we move on to our topic, let's thank our first sponsor of the night. It's the fine folks at Aerohive. Aerohive is newly listed on the New York Stock Exchange under the symbol Hive. They unleash the power of enterprise mobility. So, you know, if you've listened to Out of School since the beginning, you know that Fraser and I both love Aerohive Wi-Fi. They enable organizations of all sizes to use mobility to increase productivity, engage customers, grow their businesses, and do all kinds of fun stuff in schools as well. It's deployed in over 13,000 enterprises worldwide. Aerohive's proprietary mobility platform takes advantage of the cloud and distributed architecture to deliver unified, intelligent, simplified, and cost-effective networks. You know, with Aerohive, what's so cool about them is that there's a cloud management piece, so you can manage your access points and your switches, if you have their switches as well, from the cloud. They have you can do a private cloud or a hosted cloud where they will host it all for you in their data center. But your core network functions are dependent on that. And so, for example, you know, other companies that use the cloud, like their RF optimization is done from the cloud. So if your WAN connection, you know, is flaky one day, all that stuff is being interrupted. With Aerohive, it's a distributed architecture. So basically everything is happening at the edge of the AP. There's a firewall built into every access point. So every access point is doing deep packet inspection for application visibility and control. It's all happening at the edge. And it's really built the way the internet's built. You know, if you look at the way the internet's built, there's no centralized piece of it. It's all distributed. Our switches are built that way. There's no central switch. It's, you know, everything's happening at the edge. So as you look doing one-to-one deployments, you obviously need a great Wi-Fi infrastructure. And if you haven't looked at Aerohive already, you definitely should do that. They've got a community forum called Hive Nation. It's at community.aerohive.com. But definitely go to their website to learn more about them. It's at aerohive.com, aerohive.com. So thanks to Aerohive for sponsoring the show this week.
Absolutely. Yep. Aerohive are helping me do this exam stuff tomorrow. It's always good fun to be able to just throw up another network that works completely differently when you need it to. And that's what we do for the exams, because the iPads have to be able to print to a printer, which obviously has to be wireless. But we make sure that the devices can only route to that printer and certainly not to the internet and so on. So we just throw up another SSID that comes up for the exam time called exams, and those iPads connect to that, and then we use gated access to prevent kids from going into the settings and connecting to a different network or different SSID, so they're just connected to one network and they can print, but they can't route to the internet or download files or enable other enable other, you know, email accounts or iMessage or anything like that. So,
well, and yep. depending on your setup, like, you know, let's say, you know, you got digital exam time and you're not trying to necessarily keep them off the internet, but just want to protect your network. You go in there and say, block Netflix, block YouTube, you know, block Facebook. You could pick those applications. They're going to be bandwidth hogs, and you just like, mm-hmm. okay, you know, student network, block all that stuff. That's kind of the nice thing. Of course, you know, I think I may have mentioned this on the show. You know, Facebook has gone SSL on everything. I don't know if you knew that, like all their games and stuff, everything Facebook does has gone SSL. Obviously, you know, due to piracy, or not piracy, but privacy. Mm-hmm. So one of the downsides of that is, you know, Arrowhive and a lot of the other content filtering companies used to be able to distinguish between like Facebook games, Facebook messaging, and like Facebook, you know, this part of Facebook. But now you really can't, because there's no way to tell, because it's all encrypted.
Unless you somehow intercept the whole thing, and then it suddenly becomes a whole other job.
Yeah, then it's like a man in the middle thing. Because there, you know, that's one of the downsides. But, you know, and I tell you, I'm becoming like, I used to try to want to block some stuff on our student network. As time goes on, I'm getting more and more jaded to even try to block anything but adult content. And really want to focus more on having realistic discussion with students of like, is that appropriate? Just as if they brought a you know, hunting magazine at school that had grotesque images of animals being shot. Like, is that, it's like, you want to have those conversations with students and, you know, help them to understand and grow, not just block, but help them to understand why we have these rules in place. Because I think going forward, that's going to be a big thing. Because again, like we've said, 20 years from now, people may just have cellular connections on their devices, and we may not be able to block anything.
Yeah, and I think certainly our ability to inspect, and we talked about this in previous shows, but our ability to inspect traffic as it goes past is rapidly going away. And I think the infrastructure to do that at large scale, you know, you're starting to get into sort of NSA territory for a lot of that stuff. So it's going to be difficult to keep up the level of surveillance we have at the moment on school networks. So I think it certainly has to become a cultural
thing. If I was like a high school student now, and we had like an iPad that I could basically take control of, like, and install my own apps, mm-hmm. like, I would probably want to install a VPN service onto it, and then they couldn't block anything. But again, that's probably against the, that would probably be, it's like, I would be that guy that would get in trouble. Did I ever tell you that's the time that I got really in bad trouble in high school for something with computers?
No.
My high school used Novell. I don't know if you guys remember Novell.
And that's the first mistake.
Yeah, exactly. Well, of course, this was like, you know, 1999, 2000, showing my age. But they had a messaging feature in there that we discovered. And I accidentally sent a message to the entire campus. Principal, every teacher. Yes. Good times. Good times.
Well, let me tell you a story about messaging at school, which was when the BBC Micro computer, which is a fantastic 8-bit computer, which was connected in a ring network, because we were a fancy school. We actually had these things networked, and they were networked so that you could share a flat file system on one hard drive that all the computers were connected to store your programming on. It turned out there was a command, I think it was called talk, where you could broadcast a message along the ring to other computers. We kept that quiet for a long time before the teachers figured out that had to be disabled. But that was my experience of computing in school for the most part. And then it became Apple Color Classics, possibly. No, we definitely had black and white ones. Mac 2, I think. I'm showing my age. I can't remember the names anymore. There's too many models. That's a problem.
Yeah, we've simplified that. Now we have it's too many SKUs on iOS. Too many. I don't know. Maybe a gold iPad. Would you? No, that's okay. That'll be a great question for your next appointment. If there's a gold iPad, do people vote for that? That couldn't even be an option. Couldn't even be an option, because you know they would pick it. Every girl would pick a gold iPad.
Well, we chose a certain color for the case, and some people found out through research that there was a pink version of the case as well. And we were going for a blue and grey one because that matches our school trip uniform colours. I was being heavily lobbied, if not actually almost bribed, to allow people to choose a pink case or a blue case. But I refused on the basis that some people next year would have to get a pink case or a blue case, and that would be, they may not be entirely happy to carry that colour. So, awkward.
Yes. Anyway. Moving on.
Yeah, moving on. So, It's 14 out of 15, Bradley. We're nearly there. This is the second last episode in the show. And I think it's been a good series. I hope people have enjoyed it. I certainly enjoyed doing it. And I think I really feel that if you take on board the things that we've talked about so far and the things we'll talk about today and next time, you're definitely on the way to a very, very strong deployment.
Well, and we've gotten some great feedback. And you know, those are actually very, you know, very, I don't know that inspiring is the word, but they're very motivating when people mm-hmm. say, hey, we're going through this right now. Thanks for doing this. I'm passing, you know, the links around to our faculty to listen to and our administration team. And that was really our goal, is for someone that's like thinking through this now, for, you know, us to share, you know, some of the knowledge that we have on this area. And so maybe you can avoid some pitfalls. And that's really the ultimate goal, is, you know, let's learn from all of our mistakes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, nobody's born knowing how to do this, right? And we weren't born knowing how to do it when we started. And we didn't get everything right. We got some things right. We've learned a whole lot along the way. But life's too short to make every mistake yourself, right? You've got to learn from what other people have done in the past. And we've been hosting a whole lot of visits recently, and there are still more to come, because it's, you know, the season, exam season is when everybody's got a bit of extra spare time in the school. So, you know, we've been having a lot of conversations recently about, you know, what makes a good deployment and what doesn't. And it's interesting now that we had some people in the other day who had put out about 160 iPads in their organization. It was a training organization rather than a school as such. And they had kind of realized that they had got into a situation where the deployment wasn't being managed correctly anymore, and it was just costing them time and time and time to get things changed, to get things managed, to get things installed and removed and so on. So the conversation there was all about how do we put this deployment on a professional footing? And I think that's a conversation that is going to come up from a lot of schools who have purchased iPads already, is, well, we're in a bit of a mess. How do we get this right? How do we get it back on track? I think that conversation is going to happen for a lot of people in the next couple of years. And my hope for this series has been that people who have listened to this and taken on board what we've said will not find themselves in that situation, except in the face of evolving and changing technology, where we've always got to make shifts to get onto things like managed distribution and volume purchase and MDMs and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I'm optimistic about the future for people who have listened to the show.
Well, and I think that we were kind of lulled into a sense of simplicity a few years ago with iOS, because
yes.
I don't think anyone, when they were looking at deploying Macs 5 years ago or today, thought that, you know, we don't need someone that's trained to be able to do this. You know, that was, you needed someone to do this for you, either on mm-hmm. staff or outsourced. You needed someone that understood how to deploy Macs or PCs in your organization to understand how they all work together. Well, when people had their iPads and their iPhones, they thought, well, this is so easy that I can like install apps. I'm a whiz. I'm a power iOS user. So anybody mm-hmm. can deploy this stuff. And they thought, well, let's just buy them and let's just roll with it. And for a while, you could sort of do that. But as we mentioned multiple times over the past few months, all these changes that Apple has made have in some ways complicated the rollouts. But in other ways, they've actually simplified it, because it's simplified. You know, it's made maybe the smaller ones a little bit more complicated. But when you look at what it takes to scale it up properly, to put it on a more professional foot, it is more complicated, because it takes more planning. And you have to understand from a 50,000 foot level how the licensing works, how the, you know, how it talks to the management system, how it interacts with your Wi-Fi. You know, some of the conversations that you and I have over iMessage about Wi-Fi, you know, those mm-hmm. aren't things you just like learn from, you know, having internet at home. Like you have to have a deeper understanding about how 2.4 and 5 gigahertz work, how roaming works, how data rates work. And again, we're not trying to complicate things for the sake of complicating them. But anytime you grow something this size, there are more pieces, you know, you have to fit together.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing that I like about it, though, is that something complicated that works grows out of something simple that worked. Right, you never come into something complicated in the first day and it just works, because technology doesn't work that way. But I think, you know, the conversation I was having the other day was very much the organization I was talking to. They were in the same, they had started from the same place I started in 2010, which was, we get this iPad, we plug it into iTunes and we sync apps. So they were using the same techniques that one would have used in those days as a home iPad user, and they were trying to scale up to 100, and I think they had maybe 160 or 180 devices in their organization. Whereas you know, even back then, I kind of realized that, well, I don't think I could scale as much beyond 100, and they were pushing 160 with the same techniques. But they had not made the move to volume purchase. They had not made the move to MDM. They had not made the move to Apple Configurator even either. And it was, I think the phrase I like to use, Bradley, is I like to sort of say it has become professionalized rather than complicated. You know, I think it's a simpler user experience for both the administrator and the end user, but there's more to understand now. There are more moving parts to it, but they do fit together very well. You know, that's the good thing about it. And once you understand where the key points are and what's optional, then you can start to move on from there.
It's kind of like, you know, my kids have like little puzzles and they have multiples of them and they're all fairly easy puzzles, but none of them fit together. And as you look at puzzles that are maybe more for adults, they're smaller pieces, but they create kind of one grander picture. And that's kind of what we're doing here. Instead of having like a puzzle over here for apps, a puzzle over here for Wi-Fi, a puzzle over here for security and management, we're kind of integrating these things under one big puzzle. Yeah, it takes a little bit longer to put the puzzle together, but what you end up with is drastically better.
Yes, and I think when thinking about it recently, you know, what I feel you can do now is that you can achieve more with less effort.
Yes.
You know, we achieved a lot in 2010, but with a lot of effort. I mean, I think one of the things that I am aware of when people come and visit the school is they think it's easy because I make it look easy. You know, I say, well, we've got this bit and that bit, and we just do this, then we do that, and that's how it all works. When in fact, you know, the hours and years of effort that I've gone into it, you know, are almost hidden from view. But in 2010 and in the years after, it was a lot of effort on my part to keep it up and running and to redeploy it and to update to iOS 4 and things like that, which was just agony. And it was an investment of effort that maybe not everybody would make. But today, that level of, you know, just brute force effort is gone. And there are now tools to do so much more of that stuff directly. That it's definitely much more scalable. That's, and scalability is a thing, isn't it? That's what most of the focus has been on in the past couple of years.
It's answering the questions. You know, a few years ago we said, well, Apple doesn't have a great answer for that. And now we have answers for a lot of those scalability questions. So what's the what's the topic for this week?
Okay, so the topic, if you have been following along, you know, we've gone from initial ideas all the way through talking about teacher training, infrastructure analysis, purchasing decisions, procurement techniques, all the way down to where the rubber meets the road. And this week and next week are kind of two halves of that whole. This week we're going to talk about parent communication. And next week's going to be about how do you actually do your opening day, the D-Day we might call it, the day where we're going to deploy this stuff to everybody and the school's going to get up and running. But this week, parent communication. And I think the first idea, Bradley, that we want to get across is that you can't over-communicate with your parents. You find that?
Yeah, and we really practice that a lot at our school. We will, in your mind as a school, not even just with technology, with anything you communicate, it's very important to us. So when we have events and we have things going on, like we're raising money for a playground right now, we feel like that we bombard our parents with information about asking for money for our playground. Mm-hmm. But then you talk to parents and they say, well, I didn't really know you guys were doing that. And, you know, it's just like anything. We assume all of our emails are being read and the notes we're sending home are being read. We assume they are. But it's just like anything. It's like in marketing. It takes like, they say it takes, what is it, seven touches to actually have someone hear your message. And it's almost that way, it feels like, with schools when you're trying to communicate information to your parents that you may think you're, you know, telling somebody, you know, something in an email one time, but if you look at your logs, like in RenWeb, I can see how many people opened it. It's like 60%. Now, that is very good if you look at kind of like newsletter statistics, but it's not 100%. So you've got 40% of your people that don't know. So if you're sending out something about your deployment home one time, 40% of your people guaranteed won't see it.
Yes, that's been a real eye-opener to me as well since we started using MailChimp this year for parent communication. How few people open those emails and how few people, you know, check, at some level check their email regularly. I mean, it's kind of astonishing to people like you and I, Bradley, that there exist these lucky, lucky people in the world who don't have to check their email more than once every 4 or 5 days, and I envy them, and I envy their simple life. But I think that over-communicating, the only way you can over-communicate is when you communicate in a way that people don't understand what you mean. And it can be, like, teachers are awful prone to doing this sometimes, particularly when they get into management, where they start to speak the educational jargon and nobody understands it. They don't understand either, you know, because the words put together literally don't make any sense. You know, we had an email recently from an organization, and we sort of sat there and somebody read it out in the staff room, and we just sat there going, those words are all correct English words, but when you put them together in that order, they have literally no meaning, except for the fact that we know that when they say those words, they mean this other thing. And I think the key thing, particularly when you're talking something, some high technology deployment, is to speak in very, very plain English to people. That it's here it is, it's simple. We are going to give your child an iPad for school. Right? Not, we are engaging in a one-to-one technology rollout to enhance learning across the curriculum. Right? Nobody talks like that. Right? We're giving your child an iPad to use for school. Here's what we're going to do with it. We're going to use it for this and this and this and this. You'll see, we're going to enhance literacy with one-to-one technology in the classroom. We're going to use it for reading. We're going to use it for writing. We're going to use it for making videos to show that we know these things, right? And I think if there's one thing I could sort of beg people, it's just like, speak like a human to your parents, because the educational jargon is just all pervasive in our world, and it means nothing even to us, and it means even less to people who are not in education.
Well, you know, certainly as kind of time goes on and more and more people have smartphones. Like, you know, our generation, when like you're and I generation are, you know, the dominant generation at in parents mm-hmm. in the school, you don't have to treat them like they don't know the benefits of technology. You know, like I had had a lawn company come out, I cannot get grass to go in my backyard for nothing. I got hard rocky soil and had a
bodies buried underneath it or something.
I hope not. That wouldn't be good for anybody. So, and we've had it seeded twice, you know, right before I moved in, and then I had it reseeded last fall, and it's like half grass, and it's like patchy. And so the guy comes out there, and it was just like a regular guy. He tells me, I tell him what we've done. He said, well, here's why it didn't grow, and here's how we can fix it. Very, very simple. Didn't give me a bunch of jargon about, we're going to, he said, we're going to aerate. And I said, what is that? He goes, well, he said, you know how you dig a hole for every plant you plant? He said, we're basically digging a hole for every grass seed. He didn't go through the mechanics of what the machine does. He just gave me like a simple analogy. And it's like, oh, that works. And so you want to do that with your families, because I don't think you have to convince a lot of your parents today the benefits of technology. They have it in their workplace. They see the benefit of having technology. You know, and they also... Mm-hmm. You know, they also understand that technology doesn't replace them at their jobs, just as it doesn't like basically take the teacher out of the classroom. You know, an iPad doesn't replace the teacher.
Yeah, no, I've absolutely had that contention for a few years now. I've been kind of using it in presentations, that the idea that, you know, the average age of a first time mum in the UK is about 28 years old, right? Which means that for a child coming into school today, their mother was on average born about 1981, right? Now, somebody born in 1981 has grown up almost their entire life with technology. Certainly, they were maybe only 1 or 2 years old when the first home computer started coming into the UK. They were, I'm going to try and do mathematics in my head here, but they were maybe 13 or 14 when the consumer internet became a feature in their homes. And then when they left high school, you know, they were going to university, and they were probably not at that point quite having their own laptop just yet, but they were a couple of years away from it. And then, you know, they were early adopters of mobile phones, they were adopters of laptops and eventually smartphones and so on. So you're talking about people who, you know, there's that phrase that I hate because it's another part of the educational jargon, digital natives, right? Nobody calls themselves a digital native. the only people who call anybody natives are people who are not natives, right? And in some senses, I think it's a bit of a colonial term as well. But anyway, to unpack my rant there, the point is that these people know technology. And I really strongly feel that when parents come into your school and all you've got to show them is, you know, a couple of iPads, and you think you're hot stuff with that, and their lives are just swimming in technology, you know, that I think that struggles to impress them. And I feel that parents are really just sitting there, you know, and I don't mean just like upper middle class parents. I mean parents of all income brackets, because we know that technology is touching everybody, particularly mobile technology, smartphones, are just sitting there waiting for us to do something. You know, they're wondering what's taking so long. Because they live in a world, they live in households mainly, where technology is not a scarce thing. There's not one precious computer in daddy's study anymore. There's internet-connected devices just lying about all over the place. And they're changing them every couple of years for newer smartphones, better smartphones. And I think, in large part, parents are just wondering what's taking school so long.
Yeah, I mean, they... You know, in 2011, it was okay to have an iPad here and there. But it's you know, we're approaching the 2014-2015 school year, and it's no, you know, it's no longer the exception to be a you know, technically integrated school. It's the expectation. Our, like, that's something we talk about. That's something they're interested in.
Yeah, I mean, people ask me a lot, you know, how much has the iPad program increased enrollment at the school? And I can't say that I've ever had anybody come to the school who has said, well, we're moving here because of the iPad program. But I think when people do come and they see the iPad program, they sort of go, well, of course that's the way it should be. You know, they're not necessarily thinking about, I've got to get my kids somewhere they can get an iPad, because, you know, still the majority of schools are not that way. So maybe they don't have that expectation of all schools just yet, but I feel like when they see it, it just makes sense. You know, nobody walks in the door. I mean, I guess it's at this point it's a self-selecting process, but nobody walks in the door and goes, oh, this iPad stuff's a bit weird, maybe we'll come back another time, you know? So I think the question next, right, is, you know, to close off that part, is the idea is be optimistic, right? Don't be pessimistic and don't make assumptions about what your parents think before you know what they think. And I've encouraged some schools that I've worked with to actually do surveys, like to do opinion surveys with parents and say, well, what do you think about this? Right? But don't be beholden to that as well, because, if you know, don't be the kind of person who, well, if one person says no, then that's it off the table. Right? There's a role for leadership. We started this whole series with a discussion about leadership. There's still a role for leadership. But be optimistic. Parents are different now than they used to be. That's for sure.
Before we move on, let's thank our last sponsor for the day, the fine folks at Jamp Software. I actually had a guy in hand doing some work for me today. He said, hey, have you guys ever heard of Jamp? And I said, I have, actually, and had a nice conversation with him. He had another client looking at them. And so Jamp, as you know, they provide IT staff with enterprise tools that power widespread use of Apple technologies such as iPads, Macs, iPhones, and even Apple TVs for education organizations. Jamp is 100% dedicated to the Apple platform. It's not a secondary platform, so when Apple is moving the platform along with new APIs, you know Jamp's going to be right behind them. Now with Casper Focus, they have placed these great technologies directly into the hands of teachers who work with students every day. Casper Focus allows teachers to quickly gain students' attention, conduct secure exams within an app, select a specific Apple TV assigned to their class, choose and distribute iBooks, and even initiate AirPlay right from within Casper Focus. Learn what else you can do with Casper Focus at jampsoftware.com. That's J-A-M-F software.com. And we'll have a link to their website in the show notes too. So we want to thank the fine folks at Jamp Software this week.
Love my Jamp Software. It's
the trifecta, the Apple, Aerohive, and Jamp.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And you're done. Right, that's it. Yeah. Okay, so I guess the thing to say next, right, is what is it you're going to say to people? You know, and I think the answer is dependent on sort of where you are in the whole process, because for some people, they'll be at a situation where you're just trying to start something. And if you're just trying to start something, then you've got to kind of explain yourself and say what your plan is and where it's going. On the other hand, if you've had a trial and you're ready to go for it, then you're going to have to explain a different story. And I think in some ways the trial period one's a wee bit easier because presumably if you've got something else to say, that means the trial worked, right? But if you've had a trial and unfortunately too few people have trials that fail, you know, everybody's pilot's always a wild success. But if you have a trial and it fails, I think it's really important to communicate the reasons why it failed and what the criteria were. And, you know, particularly if you're planning to switch platforms, you know, say you started an Android pilot and then you're deciding to go with iPad. You know, it's important to include in the communication why that decision was made as well. Or if you trialed five things and you decided on iPad, you've got to state your reasons for that as well. But if you're just trying to get started, right, and I think this is a really, really important point. I don't know if you've ever seen schools do this, Bradley, but they start a trial and they don't know what the criteria are for success or failure. And in some ways, the worst situation is if it's a success, because they certainly don't have a plan for how they get on from what's going to happen after the trial, right? So we trialed iPads, it was a great success, and now what? Are we going one-to-one? Did we ever have a plan for that? You know, in some ways, the schools don't actually plan for success. You know, they plan for failure or apathy or something like that, but they don't plan for what happens if this is a wild success. And sometimes it is. And then you find yourself in a situation where you're reporting back to parents, well, we did this trial, it was an overwhelming success, but now we're sending them back to the distributor. Parents aren't going to be super happy with that. And the kids who were in the trial are certainly not going to be happy with it. But I've certainly seen that happen in some places as well. So if you are going to start a trial, it's important to have a plan for the trial being a success as well, and explain how that will be evaluated at the end.
Yeah, I mean, I think defining a lot of the success and failures up front on what, you know, what's your goal here? Like, what do you want to see? And if it's a failure, is it something that could have been corrected? Is it a failure on your part? You know, maybe your infrastructure wasn't ready. You know, and you know, again, that doesn't mean you shouldn't do something. That means you need to do this before you do that.
Yep. And I think that you've put your finger on a key point there, Bradley, which is that if you're talking about starting a trial, it's really important to be clear in your mind, and this goes back to even to the vision and leadership stuff, it's important to be clear in your mind what it is you're actually trialing, right? Because people say we're trialing iPads, but are you really trialing iPads, or are you trialing your infrastructure? Are you trialing your teacher's ability to actually absorb a change and act on it and change their practice? It's going to have to be a long trial to see any effects on that, I would say, because teachers don't change their minds overnight, that's for sure. So it's important to be clear about what's being evaluated. Is it just the device itself? Are we still in a world where we have to test the iPad to see if we can figure out what the iPad can do for us? Or is it really that you're trialing the school? Is the school actually ready for one-to-one? And in some ways, it would be refreshing if people were really honest about that and say, well, it's the school that's not ready. It's not that the iPad's not good enough or whatever. And sometimes it might be, right? I'm not saying that the iPad always has to come out a shining star, but it's important to realize that those failures could be on the part of the school, or they could be failures on the part of the teacher, they could be failures on the part of the infrastructure or the funding planning or, you know, just the organization of it. Right? It doesn't have to just say, well, the iPad's not suitable, because I think too often people come into that saying, well, our requirements are perfect and we will only accept a device that perfectly matches all of our sainted requirements, where in fact, what you really have to do, I think, is you have to look at what devices are available and then see, well, can we meet our requirements with them, or do we have to change our mind about how we do some stuff as well? And of course, the bigger the school, the harder that is as well.
Yeah. This is one of those situations where I think you need to have the ability to like answer honestly questions about your organization and to be able to say like, we failed there or we're not ready for that. Because I think if you're looking for the perfect device, you're going to be waiting a while.
Yeah. And it's always a red flag to me when people sort of fetishize the words built for education, right? They're waiting for the devices built for education because education is perfect. Education doesn't need to change. And somebody will surely just come along and build the device for education. And congratulations, it happened. It's Rupert Murdoch. It's the Amplify tablet. Enjoy that if you will. But in the real world, I think you've got to, you know, everybody who's adopted iPad has had to change their mind about something, right? Even just the consumer. You know, I don't plug my digital camera in and download it all to whatever anymore. I do this other thing, or I take the pictures on the iPad. I mean, you know, things like that have happened as well. So it's not just waiting for the perfect tablet for education is never going to come along. And in some ways, you know, people often ask me, well, what's the best thing about the iPad? And I say the fact that it's not built for education is the best part about it. The other thing I wanted to mention, Bradley, was that if you're going down the route of asking parents to contribute money to the deployment, this becomes a whole lot more tricky. I don't know if you've ever seen deployments run into the sand.
No, but I could see where it would. I mean, this could be where if you don't have good answers, this will be a big red flag to parents that you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, and certainly I think what happens when you're in that situation, and I'm not saying it's the wrong thing to do. In some situations, it's absolutely the right thing to do. In some situations, it's the only thing you can do is to ask parents to contribute. But what you are doing, and you should be aware of this before you go in, is you're inviting a much higher level of scrutiny on yourself and on your deployment if you ask for money up front before you've shown any real meaningful results. And one of the things I see when I go and do parents' nights at other schools quite a lot is, you know, parents, they don't need to be told about what the iPad is, but if you're asking them for money, quite often the question that comes up is, well, how do I know you're going to actually use it? Right? And that question is not a question about screen time or spending too much time on the iPad. It's a question actually directed at the school and the teaching organization, in the sense that how do I know that you are going to be adaptable enough to put this device into good use and actually really wear it out? Because if I'm paying for it, I want it used. So that's going to bring that question in as well. I'm not saying that can't be answered. It absolutely can. But you've got to be aware that that question is probably going to come. And on that question of questions, you know, I think you've seen those episodes in The West Wing where, you know, people are preparing for debates and they've got somebody from their own side hammering them with questions and so on. I think that's actually a really, really valuable technique. If you're going to go out in front of, you know, 400 or 500 parents and you're going to open the mic for Q&A, you want to have practiced all the questions. And I think debate prep, if you like, for head teachers or lead teachers going into that situation is an extremely helpful technique. And I've certainly been involved a couple of times in doing that with people, you know, throwing out questions like, well, what about Android? What are you going to say when somebody says that question? What about Windows tablet? You know, what about buying all these HP touchpads at the fire sale? You know, I think there's a lot of typical questions that come up, and there's some more esoteric ones that come up as well. But I just thought maybe we could run through some of the really simple ones and see where the answers can come from with that, right? So I guess the first one that always comes up is, well, like, why are you doing this, right? Or why now is another form of that question. Particularly, that question tends to come up if the school's facing other challenges as well. And I know in the past couple of years, obviously, you know, recessionary budgets have been difficult. Some school systems have been laying off teachers. And that's a really hard time to try and bring in a technology deployment when you're firing teachers at the same time. So people come and say, why now when you're firing teachers or you're selling off the playing fields or whatever, or the roof's leaking, why are you doing this? You know, and I've certainly worked with some people who have been in very, very dilapidated school buildings, but instead of, you know, fixing the fabric of the building, they're going for the technology instead. And they face that question a lot. And it's not that there isn't an answer to it. And the answer is typically that we think there'll be more educational benefit to the IT deployment than fixing the roof or whatever. So there's that one. Obviously, how much will it cost is always a question. Scottish people typically have a bit of a reputation for being a little concerned about money. And in some areas, it tends to become the number one, if not the only question is, well, how much money is this all costing? And, you know, if you give people the headline figure, right, the way I've always handled that is I say, well, it's this amount per pupil per month. And I think the question, where that question comes from, if you say, well, it's £60,000 or it's £100,000 or something, folk are like, whoa, 100 grand for kids to go on computers. Whereas if you say, well, it's £8.50 per pupil per month. And then I say, well, guess how much it is for a teacher per pupil per month, right? It's like £60 per pupil per month for a teacher or whatever. Then I think that question, when people are shocked at how much a computer costs, that just tells you that they don't know how much education costs, what the real costs are of delivering education, and particularly in state schools where people pay £0 for their education up front. They genuinely have literally no conception of how much is actually being spent to deliver the education that their child is getting.
Yeah, it's when you look at things like what is the electricity cost, what is lunch cost, what is HR cost, a technology deployment in the grand scheme of your budget is a minimal amount.
Yeah, I was having that conversation just the other day with some visitors. I was saying, look, we lease this device and it costs us about £9 per pupil per month. And I just saw a light bulb go off above their head because they were having a big debate in their organization about whether they could get, £20,000 to buy some more iPads. And they were like, that amount per pupil, right? Well, we know how much a student brings into our organization, and it's whatever price it was from the training providers and so on. And if we shave off, a part of that for this and a part of it for that, then suddenly that's a no-brainer. It's a trivial cost compared to the overall cost of staff and running the building and so on. So arguments about cost can be overcome, I think.
Well, I think this will largely depend on the financial situation of your school and how you're funded.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. But I also have observed over time that parents' enthusiasm for these kind of deployments is not directly correlated with their wealth. Because I've been to, very, very wealthy schools where parents have been reluctant to either pay or be charged for technology deployments. And I've been to some of the poorest schools where people are queuing up around the block to sign up to pay for their children to get an iPad for school. I'm having a conversation the other day with people from a school in a very high area of deprivation in Glasgow. And they were saying, we know the economic status of some of our families, yet we know that their parents are carrying smartphones. That they maybe don't actually have, the kids don't really have enough clothes to get by, but the parents have got a smartphone. And the prioritization of technology, and I'm not necessarily saying that one should prioritize buying a smartphone or a tablet over putting clothes on your children, but it's an indication of the value that's placed upon technology and communication and that kind of thing over and above even some of the other, what we might call the basics of life, And I think that's an interesting factor and trend to look at as well. Okay, other questions that you can sort of war game around. Some parents will always ask you about handwriting. Parents are very sentimental about handwriting. I was going to say I'm not decrying handwriting, but I sort of am. I mean, I handwrite stuff as well, but I handwrite a post-it note's worth of stuff compared to what I type. And I think that the simple answer to that question is always just, well, we're still teaching handwriting. Let's move on, right? And don't let it become, because when I was new into this stuff, I would get into that argument to people and I would say, well, think about it. I would get into the whole kind of futurist stuff and I'd be like, well, how much do you think you're going to handwrite in the future and all that kind of stuff? And of course, the answer is always, well, they've still got to sit exams, right? But I think it's probably better today just to say, well, we still teach handwriting. Let's move on to the next question, because you are going to still teach handwriting, right? I mean, there's no school, and we're not a school who just doesn't bother teaching handwriting anymore. There'll be somebody who will ask about screen time. You get this question, Bradley?
No.
How much time do children spend? How much time should they spend on computers?
No, but I think if you get this question, I think it's important to be upfront with parents and say, look, when we do a one-to-one deployment, they will be in front of a screen more than they were before. But we still find value in the real world, in real world experiments. We still find value in PE and things that are in the world, but also being honest and say, look, that's just a part of, you know, technology is a part of life now, and we want to teach good habits.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I don't think that there's no case to be made about managing screen time, but I'm also very grateful to have grown up in a time where that wasn't a concept. I mean, I had just unlimited time on the computer as a child. I mean, I can hardly remember a time when my parents would come in and shut me down after an hour. And I think since we've invented the concept of screen time, and now we're all panicking because the kids aren't very good on computers anymore. Like, well, duh. But I think one of the lines I've always taken about screen time is that when you are one-to-one, and particularly when you're one-to-one with something that's as simple to use as a tablet, it's very easy to make it an IT lesson, and it's very easy to stop it being an IT lesson as well. When you have a laptop trolley that you have to laboriously book and elaborately set up before you can do any lesson, then it kind of puts a pressure on you to do a full hour of IT at one time in one sitting, because that's when you've got the resources. Whereas when you're one-to-one, it's still totally okay to just put it away. It's not okay to put it away and never bring it out again. That's a whole different story. But you don't have to always be doing it on the computer, you see? And I think there's one place where I am careful when people are trying to justify their iPad purchase purely on the basis of cost savings. Because when you justify it, like, you know, if we get iPads, we can stop doing this and this and this and this and this. And eventually you add so many things onto that list that you do end up doing everything on the iPad because you've got to realize the cost savings that you promised a year ago. That's the big downside to cost savings justification for iPad deployment. But I think it's also, like, you'll get some people who just have an attitude about this. And you have to sort of just find a way to assuage their fears and make them realize that perhaps they're possibly being a little bit extreme on the issue as well. Like, we only allow our children to look at a screen for 1 hour a day. Right, well, maybe you're better off at a Steiner school or a Montessori school or something like that. You know, maybe this isn't the right kind of school for you as well. So screen time is a thing, yeah. Do you ever get anybody asking you about the health impact of Wi-Fi?
No. Have you?
Lucky you.
Yeah.
I have had it in the past, yeah. I kind of jokingly refer to them as Wi-Fi truthers. But there are people who are concerned about the possible impact of electromagnetic radiation, low-level continuous electromagnetic radiation on the human body. And it's difficult. It's difficult to prove that there is no impact, right? I mean, that's science, right? You can't prove a negative. But I think the line I've always taken with people who are very strong on that point is, well, one, you're only in school for 13% of your hours in a year. And two, all the sort of well-regarded research tends to suggest that there isn't a major risk. You know, and my line has always been that we follow the Scottish government's education department advice, which is just, it basically says there's no reason not to use Wi-Fi in schools. You know, and my usual line is, if you want to take this further, please refer to the Scottish education department and go and talk to them, please, because neither I nor you know enough to go any further in this conversation, basically. But there are certainly scientific papers out there that do purport to show that there are such impacts. But what, having had some of these sent to me over the years, what I find is that a lot of those are coming from institutes where they are specifically funded to study the impact of electromagnetic radiation on the human body. And at that point, you're kind of like, well, what else are they going to figure out? You know, are they really going to come back and say, well, there's nothing, just shut us down, you know? I think the jury's very much out on that, but not that far out on it either. And it's not a major, I wouldn't say it's not something that like 40% of your parents are going to be concerned about. It's more something that the odd one in 400 might have a real thing about. You'll get questions about cyberbullying as well, of course. And I think that in that case, I've always just tended to refer back to our education program on that and just say, well, you know, this doesn't change that. You know, we did that teaching before, we do that teaching again. Our monitoring is still in place, our filtering is still in place. But also to be aware that, you know, if you are going to send it home, that does change the dynamic a little bit. And the initial conversations we often had about that was to put a wee bit more back onto the parents and say, well, on your network, your filtering will apply, right? Which is a wee bit of sleight of hand because most of them don't have any filtering on their network. But it does kind of help them to realize that, well, maybe I should be a wee bit more responsible about what comes over my internet connection that I provide for the family as well as the one that's in the school. Because it's by no means the only internet connection that kids are on. I mean, that was the 90s, right, where schools were often the first place that somebody had the internet, had an internet connection. And that's no longer the case. It really isn't.
Well, and yeah, parents want to look at it and say, well, what are you doing at your school? And you really, the question is, to me, things like that are a bigger issue at home at night, late at night, when kids are not mm-hmm. in school and not being monitored. And so that's more of a question. It's like, let's help you secure your Wi-Fi and let's have an honest conversation about what services your kids are using.
Yeah, because, you know, you can get into a situation where, you know, you're talking to somebody who's given their child a TV in the room, an Xbox Live in the room, and an unfiltered internet connection in the room, and they're demanding to know what you're doing in a school situation where they're supervised almost all the time. And I'm like, well, what's going on when you're not supervising them at home on that connection? You know, so it's a wee bit of pushback on that as well, because maybe not so much now, but certainly a few years ago, I think parents were very naive about what they had already done in terms of giving their children access to, or potential access to, material that they regarded as not suitable. But in all the years, I've never had a major request from parents to really do something about what goes on at home. The only one I ever had was somebody who asked me if I could block BBC iPlayer on their kid's iPad at home, which I couldn't do, of course, unfortunately. So yeah, cyberbullying, you know, that's a question, but it's something parents should have been concerned about before. And probably they already are concerned about it, you know, and they're just what they're really asking for is assurance that the problem's not going to get any worse. And I think my experience has been that our peak cyberbullying year was 2008, really, or 2009, when Facebook really started becoming a thing and kids thought that adults couldn't see their Facebook, you know, you know, we had a number of incidents we had to deal with back then, but it certainly hasn't gotten any worse. I think kids have gotten a lot savvier. We've certainly taught better about it as well. And I think, you know, the whole issue of online behavior is such a much more prominent story in the media now than it's ever been before, that people are much more aware that what happens online can have actual consequences in the real world as well. Okay, what have we got left in this? How much will it be used? We sort of talked about that already a little bit, didn't we?
Yeah, and I think you know, that kind of goes along with the next one is, you know, what will it be used for? And I don't think these situations where you need to break out lesson plans for every class and say, well, in these lessons, this is how we're using iPad. You know, but you also want to find a balance and not just talk, you know, have a education-centric jargon discussion about differentiated instruction and how this affects the learning process, and just talk about, say, you know, we're using technology to go faster, to be better, to be able to do different things we couldn't do before. But mm-hmm. I don't think you need to get so detailed where you're breaking out, giving them copies of lesson plans for the quarter.
Yeah, and I think if you're new to the whole process as well, I don't think you can have a very good answer to that until you've tried it. I mean, I know that what I thought we were going to use the iPad for back in 2010 and what we actually used it for then and what we do use it for now is wildly different, you know. And I think that in some ways you've got to get a bit of experience under your belt before you can have a more detailed answer to that. So, you know, there's going to be a vision for what you use it for, but a vision is a plan with no experience, right? Whereas, you know, come the end of the year, it would be very much worth going back to those parents and saying, well, we're at the end of our first year, come and see all the things we did with it and have parents come to the school or send home, you know, digital artifacts, videos audio books writing that students made using that technology over the year, and say, well, we'll tell you about it at parents' evening, and we'll tell you about it at the end of the year, and we'll show you what we've done, and really, you know, showcase the success after you've had some. That's a really, really powerful way to give feedback on it. And I think at some level, parents trust the schools, right? It's not a completely adversarial and suspicious relationship. These people are trusting you with their children. And if they don't trust you at some level, you've got a bigger problem than whether or not they think your technology is any good.
I agree. I mean, particularly the private schools, parents spend a lot of money, and they they do that because they feel like you're the experts. And when a school chooses new curriculum, you know, parents trust them that, okay, you are the expert. You know, like if my builder changes drills, I don't care. You're the expert. If that drill's better, go for it. If this wood is better for my house, go for it. You're the expert. Mm-hmm. I'm paying you for your expertise.
Yeah. I remember, you know, when I first started teaching, that during the first few parents nights, I couldn't quite understand how much trust these people had in me. You know, this sort of, it was weird to be, you know, young as I was at the time, and have people being sort of very deferential towards me because I was a teacher. You know, I was like, all right, I'm the teacher. Hang on. Yeah, okay. Well, maybe I didn't know anything back then, but certainly know a few more things now. But yeah, you know, the role of a teacher still has a very, it's still a prestigious role in society. I think even in, you know, your country, my country, where teachers perhaps feel a little more disrespected than they have in the past, are less respected than they are in other countries where the role of a teacher is held in extremely high regard. But I still believe that, you know, being a teacher is something that people definitely look up to and respect and invest a lot of faith in the expertise that you show. And I think that you can use that for a lot of good. And this is an opportunity to do that. And to the last question, Bradley, why not this other device that I really like? Always there's going to be this question. You know, I'm an Android guy. Why are you not using Android tablets? They're half the price of iPad, right? Well, how long have you got for me to explain the answer to that question? The answer to that question depends on how you got to where you are. You know, if you've done an extensive comparison and trial, then present the results of that comparison and trial. Present the criteria and show why you made your decision. Because presumably, you've made your decision because that trial showed something that gave you a reason to think that this was the right choice. If that decision is based on experience from other schools, then go ahead and cite that experience in other schools. Right? If you've heard terrible things about Android deployments, tell people. Right? You know, don't kid on that everything's the same, and I'm just making a choice. Right? Because that's weakness. Right? And too often, I think, in educational technology, the committed, technically able teacher can see the learning value in everything. Right? And this is, in some ways, the weakness of teachers who know about technology, is that they sort of look positively on everything. And that leads them to be sometimes, to struggle sometimes to make a decision for one thing over another, because you can see the positive use that everything could have in education. And I strongly feel when you're trying to lead a whole school culture change like this, that you have to be the guy or the girl who puts their foot in the ground and says, here are the reasons why we are making this choice, and I will defend all these reasons to you to the death, right? The reasons might change in the future, the device might change in the future, but it's super important that you don't just say, well, you know, we know they're both kind of as good as each other, but we're getting this one that's twice the price because we think it's a wee bit more robust. Right, that's not good enough. Right, you need to have 10 reasons why it's better, and you could cite 10 reasons why it's better. Right, the apps are better, the hardware is faster, the turnaround time is better in repairs. You know, the experience of damage rates is much lower. There's so many cases available. There's tons of software available. It's much more powerful. There's technologies like AirDrop. The NDM management system is better on iOS than it is on Android. Right. I haven't even rehearsed these. I don't have these in my notes, but those are just off the top of my head. Those are the reasons why I would go iOS over Android in the tablet space right now. So my fundamental point with question and answer with parents is that if you know there's a question you don't want to get, then you've done something wrong in your planning. You haven't thought something through enough. And if you're afraid of somebody asking the question, then you better go back and figure out whatever is wrong with your answer to the question and fix it, and then do your parents' night. Don't just try and hope that nobody comes up with it, because somebody will come up with it. And the bigger a school you've got, the more probability you have that somebody will think of that question and just either ask it for fun to embarrass you, or, you know, do their due diligence and ask that question because you don't actually have a good enough answer for it as well.
Yeah, that's, you want to make a good impression on this kind of stuff, especially in the beginning, leading up to D-Day. You don't want to seem like that you're winging it. You want to seem like you've got, you know, things nailed down.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen parents' night Q&A just go so badly off the rails because of this. Not in our school, but in schools that I've been to, and I've presented at their parents' night, and then, you know, the head teacher, this actually happened one time, the head teacher got up and he said, well, any questions? And the first question is, like, how much are you going to use this in the classroom? And the guy just had not thought of an answer to that question. It's just like, well, we're trialing it in science and we've got some ideas for how we might use it in maths and in English. The whole place, I mean, that was just the end of the night. I should have just walked out at that point because everything was just like, well, he doesn't know how they're going to use it, so why am I paying for this, right? Whereas, you know, if you know, there's perhaps better ways to handle the mass Q&A as well, but if he had had a good answer for that, a comprehensive answer, here are the five things we expect everybody to be doing by the first 6 weeks, and then we're going to advance into this and this and this, then that would have been a very compelling statement that people would absolutely in that school, I know, have bought into and really gotten behind and championed the program. But because he gave a kind of milquetoast answer to the whole thing and just said, well, we've got some ideas here and there, but we're still doing this £150,000 deployment anyway, people were much, much less impressed at that. Okay, anything else we want to talk about, Bradley?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of it's paperwork. When you're talking about, you know, you're planning your deployment, you know, get copies of all your, you know, agreements, be upfront and honest about all your policies. So, you know, don't leave gray areas when it comes to that kind of stuff, and do your due diligence on making sure every parent signed every piece of paperwork. They need to, and then process it properly. But, you know, when it comes to, you know, when it comes to things like damage, you know, who's paying for damage, who's responsible for this, when, you know, if it's broken, have all that stuff nailed down and make sure your parents know the answers to that. And if they don't, have a place on your website where they can find it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You don't want to have a parent coming in and you're like trying to negotiate who's paying for what if it's broken. Like, that needs to be decided.
Yes, it does. It does. And I think, you know, You can almost sell any particular decision, but you've got to sell a decision. You know, you're absolutely right. You can't be making that policy up on the fly once there's an iPad just, you know, with bits of glass falling off the front of it sitting on the desk and everybody's trying to decide whose responsibility this is. Yeah.
A couple of things before we finish up. You know, have a dedicated section on your website with FAQs, downloads. You know, you could even record some training, you know, upload it to a Vimeo page, like how to connect this to your Wi-Fi at home or how to do that. And, you know, have a good section of it. And on there, you get this term from Apple. They use a term called DRI, the directly responsible individual. So on there, say, you know, if this happens, contact this person. Like in our notes home that goes out every week, we say, if you have problems logging into RenWeb, email me. I am the DRI for RenWeb. And so you need to have that kind of information for your parents. Give them a single point of contact. Don't have them have to like call, ask the teacher. The teacher's like, well, you probably want to talk to the IT person. The IT person says, well, you probably need to talk to the operations manager. You know, have someone that can own the problem or own the question.
That's really powerful. I mean, for us, it's mostly me, right? But the one thing that I do hand off to other people is, you know, if a parent wants access to their child's iTunes U courses, I don't have the big catalog of all the iTunes U enrollment codes because we sort of give that up to teachers. But that's something that's a guidance teacher's problem. So I say, talk to your guidance teacher, they'll pull that together for you and they'll send you an email. So there's some bits we'll push off to other people, but most of the technical stuff ends up in my door.
So be it. Well, and you know, you have that, there's that balance in our roles, especially in smaller schools, because you have a tendency to just want to handle stuff for parents on the first contact. But again, sometimes you do have to, you know, pass it along. A lot of times what I'll do, like if a parent emails me a question that is, you know, is really meant for our development director or something, I will respond to the parent and say, hey, I got your question. I don't know the answer to that, but I'm CCing, you know, Ellen, which is our development director. And, you know, on this, Ellen, can you follow up with Mr. So-and-so? So it's not like I'm saying, well, you have to contact Ellen. I'm kind of contacting Ellen on their behalf.
Yeah, that's just a professional way to turn over these things, isn't it? You know, I think it's that's the way sort of people expect to be handled now, and it's the right thing to do as well.
You know, and lastly, you know, I think this goes without being said, don't overpromise the educational benefits of a deployment. You know, don't say things like your kid will never learn the same way again. I mean, don't oversell it. Don't be the as seen on TV salesman. Talk about that. You know, this is a transition for the school. This is a long-term transition. You know, obviously, business is moving this way. Society is moving this way. But we're going to have bumps in the road. We're going to adjust as we need to. But this is something that we're doing, and we're going to stick with.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is key there to emphasize the idea that once this is done, it's done. You know, this, particularly if you're not doing a trial or if you've done a trial, that the time for trials and debate is over. This is the decision. This is what we're going to do. Right, and it's not optional for the teachers. It's not optional for the parents. It's something we're going to do, and this is how this school is going to work from now on. And I think certainly once you get over that and you do make it that way, then you know it will be the case that it's very difficult for, once you really get it embedded in the culture, very difficult for the school to go backwards. But what is very interesting to me, I'm hearing more and more stories about is schools where it didn't get embedded in the culture and then the person that was responsible for the program left. And it is perfectly possible for your one-to-one deployment to disappear in the course of 6 months if it's not really a thing that people do in the culture. And I know now, like at Cedars, if I was to leave Cedars, for example, okay, they'd need to hire somebody to do the technical side of it, but I know that the teachers here would keep this going. Cedars would still be a one-to-one school in 10 years' time because it's now part of the school culture. It's how this school works. If it's being pushed up the hill every time by somebody else, you know, and people are having to be persuaded to use the iPad, then that can just fall away so easily.
Yeah, and that could be, you know, if the headmaster is the one that's pushing it and it doesn't really get any buy-in from the faculty, well, he or she leaves and, all right, we don't have to do that anymore is the attitude. And the attitude, mm-hmm. at our school and at Cedars is, this is just the way of life. This is like, it's just, you know, like having pencils. And this is just part of it.
Yeah. And that comes from the head teacher too. I mean, I think it's also important to realize that if you want to do this kind of program and you don't even have the head teacher in the room, I would probably just give up at that point.
Yes.
However much you actually want it, I just don't feel that it's really going to be that easy for, you know, just one of, you know, however many teachers to get the whole school to do an iPad program. If I get a contact from a school and I don't get the head teacher phoning me up, it's pretty unlikely that I'm going to do a whole lot with that school. And that's not me being precious or trying to be fancy about the whole thing, but it's just the reality that I want to work with schools who are going to make the change. I don't want to spend my time just helping people dabble with iPads. And when you get the head teacher in the room, it doesn't matter how rich or poor the school is. It doesn't matter whether you're on the best Wi-Fi connection or not. What matters is if you've got the people in there that can force cultural change or lead cultural change, perhaps rather than enforce it. But if they can lead cultural change across the school, you've got a fighting chance no matter what else is in your way.
Sounds like a great place to wrap up.
Let's leave it there.
Before we go, school's coming to the end for most of us. And I have one mm-hmm. piece of parting advice. If you're not a teacher listening to this, if you're in an administration role or IT, is to make a point to go talk to every one of your teachers, tell them have a good summer, tell them you enjoyed working with them this year, and let them know kind of your contact information and hours for the summer if they need any help with anything. So if your hours change or the days you work change, just so they're aware of that. I find that like just kind of saying goodbye to teachers for the summer, I think they really appreciate that. You know, and say, hey, I'm going to be on vacation these 2 weeks, and my hours normally are this and that, and so feel free to stop by anytime if you need anything or need any help planning out next year.
Mm-hmm. Throw a party for them.
Yes, enjoy your summer.
Yeah, I did that a couple of times. I haven't done it recently. Maybe I'll do it again. You know, it's a nice way to sort of just celebrate the end of the year, particularly when it's been a trying year, as some recent years have been. You know, we've been through a lot of transition in Scotland in education, and people are pretty tired now. You know, I feel like this year, you know, all of our primary teachers have been through curriculum transition, and secondary teachers have been kind of building up and building up and building up, and now it's finally here. You know, people are kind of like, oh, you know, and I think, you know, I don't know if we've got a budget for a spa day or something, but even just going out for dinner would probably just round off the year nicely.
All right. Well, I want to thank the fine folks at Jamf Software and Aerohive for sponsoring the show this week. Mm-hmm. And where can they find us on the interwebs?
On the webs, we are outofschool.net/. It is .net, isn't it?
Yes.
Oh, that's how tired I am. Outofschool.net/deploy2014 is the homepage for this series of podcasts. You can find us on iTunes. You can find us in the search feature of your podcast client. If you wanted to leave a review in iTunes, that would be super. That would really help people find the show and understand what it's all about. I'm Fraser Spears on Twitter and spears.org on the web.
I am Bradley Chambers on Twitter and on the web at chambersdaily.com.
Okay, we'll catch everybody next week for the last show of the series.
Have a good week.